When disaster strikes, will we descend into dystopia or come together in cooperation?
Walkaway, I think of as a kind of optimistic disaster novel. So I don't think that there's anything intrinsically pessimistic in writing about disasters. I actually think that disaster is a pretty realistic thing to anticipate. And so what really makes the difference between a disaster and a catastrophe, between optimism and pessimism, is the belief that when disaster strikes, that either we'll weather it gracefully, because that's what we do, because we're people and we're smart and we're good and we solve problems when they arise and we solve problems by taking care of each other, or the belief that when the wheels come off, the whole thing is going to blow up.
That's Cory Doctorow. We talk with him about his new novel, Walkaway. Then, DeAndre Harris was assaulted August 12th by white supremacist thugs in Charlottesville, Virginia. That was bad enough, but it almost got worse.
At that moment, I turn around to follow DeAndre to make sure he's okay and hopefully get some photos of him as well. And that's when I'm confronted with a man with a handgun, 9mm Glock, as far as I can tell, who is pointing it at DeAndre and his friends and in the general area, the counter-protesters.
That's filmmaker Zach Roberts. He was on the scene when DeAndre Harris was assaulted. We talk with him about the assault and more. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. We're taught from an early age that competition is the best survival strategy. Everyone's out for their own, and the devil takes the hindmost. But what if that's not true? What if cooperation is the real survival strategy? As we confront a century where disasters may threaten civilization, will we devolve into some Hunger Games-like dystopia? Or will we work together to find creative solutions that can serve us all? These are issues much science fiction concerns itself with. Most of it seems to imagine a dystopian future. But as my guest Cory Doctorow wrote in Wired magazine, quote, disasters don't have to end in dystopias. His terrific new novel, Walkaway, posits a breakaway society in the U.S. that rejects the capitalist economy with its few winners and many losers in favor of a gift economy that benefits all. Its characters have walked away from the notion that abundance is defined by what you have. They define it by doing things for the love of doing them and the love for people around them. And when disaster strikes, this gift economy proves to be the best way for them to survive. Cory Doctorow is the author of numerous books, including Makers, Little Brother, and Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. Cory Doctorow, welcome to Writer's Voice. This novel, Walkaway, you know, actually my son turned me on to the book. He authors a website called the Utopian Encyclopedia, which curates ideas for a better world from a broad and eclectic range of sources. And he's been telling me for years that dystopian fiction is part of a dominant narrative to discourage people from making positive change. You know, it's kind of the idea to get people to accept the idea that the future is necessarily bleak. Your novel has been described as utopian, and I wonder if you could comment on that idea of utopian novels versus dystopian novels.
I think there's maybe a problem with the causal direction that trends in science fiction move in. Science fiction definitely is responsive to trends. Writers read the same things that readers do in approximately the same measure. And so we get excited about or interested in the same themes that our readers do as well. But really what happens is that writers write all the futures they can think of, and then readers pick up on the ones that resonate with them. And that's where the feedback loop comes from. There's a kind of selective pressure on science fiction that comes from readers and editors choosing what it is that interests them. So I think that when you see a rise of dystopian literature, it's not because there's anyone who's engaged in a kind of conspiracy or even a concerted project to influence the way that people think. It's rather that the way that people are thinking is steering the conversation in science fiction. And so if we see a rise in this sense of hopelessness, it may come from a kind of wider collective unconscious about where we are and where we're heading. Now, that said, Walkaway, I think of as a kind of optimistic disaster novel. So I don't think that there's anything intrinsically pessimistic in writing about disasters. I actually think that disaster is a pretty realistic thing to anticipate. After all, engineers who design systems on the assumption that nothing will ever go wrong with them aren't optimists. They're fools, and they don't build good systems. They build the Titanic when they do that. And so what really makes the difference between a disaster and a catastrophe, between optimism and pessimism, is the belief that when disaster strikes, when the second law of thermodynamics asserts itself, that either we'll weather it gracefully, because that's what we do, because we're people and we're smart and we're good and we solve problems when they arise, and we solve problems by taking care of each other, or the belief that when the wheels come off, the whole thing is going to blow up, that rather than coasting to a gentle stop, as the first sign of crisis, everyone around us will reveal themselves to have been secret beasts all along and will immediately pounce on the opportunity to, you know, devour one another. And particularly, there's a kind of class and racial dimension to this, in that oftentimes in those what the British called the cozy disaster novels, in those cozy disaster novels, it's the upstanding white upper class aristocrat defending themselves from the racialized poor bestial masses who have only been barely kept in check by law and order by law and order for all these years.
Yeah, and your narrative, I mean, I understand what you say about the collective unconscious and where people are coming from, but I also think that your narrative is very much a conscious effort to reveal a different kind of thinking, a different kind of solution. I mean, of course, not alone. I mean, there have been novels that have questioned the very fundamental assumptions of our socio-political system.
Well, I think that there's, like, in addition to kind of whatever political or social project is reflected in that view, and I will cop to being someone who generally believes in the goodness of humans and am proud to count myself among their number, I also think that there's, like, a good dramatic reason to focus on people being kind to one another in times of crisis and still maybe not being able to solve their problems or not being able to agree on what to do, as opposed to this man against nature against man story that we often get in pulp literature, where, you know, the building falls down in the earthquake and then your neighbors come over to steal all your stuff and eat you. And I think that that's because it's more realistic to imagine a disaster in which people are revealed mostly to be good, although not always to know exactly what to do with that goodness. There's a wonderful book that inspired Walkaway by Rebecca Solnit called A Paradise Built in Hell. And she's a historian, and she references primary source materials, the contemporaneous accounts written by people in times of disaster, from the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco to the Haiti earthquake to Hurricane Katrina and many other disasters, and documents what I think most of us know to be true in our hearts, which is that in times of disaster, the kind of refrigerator hum of civilization stops abruptly. And what rushes in to fill the silence is the realization that you have a shared destiny with the people around you and a duty to them to go and do what you can to help alleviate their suffering. That, you know, after 9/11, it wasn't that the streets were filled with looters. The streets were filled with people who were taking in their neighbors, volunteering, and trying to figure out what to do. And there's only so much suspension of disbelief to go around in the course of reading a story. And if you squander the reader's suspension of disbelief on this narrative convenience that makes the story more immediately exciting, this idea that the disaster is attended immediately by human bestiality and is therefore extremely fast-paced and fast-moving, if you ask the reader to suspend their disbelief about that fact of human nature, you leave less suspension of disbelief around for the reader to spend on caring about what happens to the characters. You know, after all, the major suspension of disbelief that has to take place in any novel is the belief that any of this stuff matters, right? That these made-up stories about made-up people who don't exist, never existed, will never exist, that these made-up stories have any consequence at all. And, you know, getting the reader to feel something about these imaginary, inconsequential people whose lives never existed and therefore whose suffering has no impact in the real world and no importance, that's the thing that novelists have as their first duty. And if you ask the reader to expend some of their suspension of disbelief on the nonsensical project of believing that everyone's a total bastard, despite the fact that you and everyone you know are more or less okay, then you've just got less left over for that really crucial job that you want the reader to do that makes the novel itself entertaining and enjoyable.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Cory Doctorow about his latest novel, Walk Away. Yes, and actually I was going to mention Rebecca Solnit's book because I kept on thinking about it as I was reading Walk Away, Cory Doctorow. But it seems to me that it's more than just something to propel the narrative, because you really dig in deep to exploring ideas of human nature, of what actually propels people to help each other. The characters in this novel go through an inordinate amount of introspection, and it's actually fascinating introspection, questioning their motives, testing to see if they're thinking the old way or the new way. So I wonder if you could talk about what is some of that old way that they're trying to free themselves from, these walkaways, and what are some of the new ways that they're thinking?
Well, you know, there's this ongoing movement, the rationalist movement or Bayesian reasoning movement, that is often associated with the political right, but doesn't really have a political allegiance in and of itself. And it's this idea that we acknowledge that our reasoning apparatus is subject to systematic bias, that we make reliable mistakes in the way that we think about the world and what's happening in it, and that this is often the source of our great misery and comeuppance. Whether that's things like confirmation bias, where we take inordinate notice of things that confirm our existing beliefs, and then fail to take any real notice or to recall things that disconfirm those beliefs, or the other forms of systematic cognitive problems like the availability heuristic, where we overestimate the probability of things that are easy to imagine, and we underestimate the importance of things that are hard to call to mind or hard to picture. This is actually a really serious problem that the book tries to get into, both directly and in the narrative, because it's really easy to call to mind really cinematic forms of danger, like terrorist attacks or the kidnapping of our children by strangers. But those are, very unlikely events. They're not the kinds of things that happen very often. And, the overall mortality from them is pretty much a rounding error, statistically insignificant. But we spend a lot of time preparing for them, and we do so at the expense of things that are really genuinely risky, things that claim a lot of lives, like, say, traffic accidents or, listeria. We don't have a $1 trillion war on inadequate refrigeration, and that actually kills our kids. We are in material risk because of it. And so one of the things that the walkaways spend a lot of time doing is trying to figure out why they feel in certain ways, whether or not they are responding to kind of, their great bugaboo, which is self-serving BS, or whether they are seeing clearly through their mind's propensity for tricking them into thinking that the thing that's convenient is also the thing that's right, so that in the long term, they feel good about the choices that they've made, even though those choices might be harder to make in the short term. It's not so far off from, just becoming an adult, which has so much to do with balancing out our long-term ambitions and our short-term needs and wants, and trying to figure out how to make both of those balance out, how to do what economists call discounting of the net present value for the future reward, whether that's figuring out that although you might really enjoy a slice of pizza today, you won't enjoy the extra time you'll have to put in the gym tomorrow, or figuring out that the thrill that you might get from having a romantic affair will be overtopped by the pain of the breakup of your marriage, or understanding that, you know, practicing the piano today gets you the benefit of fluency with it tomorrow. And, you know, applying that same kind of maturity and executive control, something that's been very lacking in much of our debate and right now in our political scene, very famously, the lack of executive control has become a kind of great electable trait that our politicians seem to need in order to gain office. You know, that's like the path to long-term happiness. And it's the thing that the walkaways are trying to do, and they're trying to do it in their romantic lives. They're trying to do it in their economic lives. They're trying to do it in their technological lives. They're trying to understand whether, you know, Facebook style oversharing is really the path to long-term happiness, despite the short-term pleasure that they get from social reward. Is the long-term pleasure going to be commensurate with it, or will it be overshadowed by the long-term pain of having inadvertently over-revealed or having in some other way gotten into trouble with your disclosures?
And yet, really, you're talking about much more fundamental issues. I mean, this book involves a critique of predatory capitalism, and the walkaways are walking away from it into a gift economy. And I wonder if you could talk about that gift economy. What is it, and how does it function? And before we do that, just briefly orient the listener to the bifurcated world of the novel.
Sure. Well, you know, Walkaway is a kind of if this goes on story where market capitalism has increased the distance between the rich and the poor to the point where they really no longer inhabit the same world at all. The amount of working people needed to keep the systems running has dropped so far because of automation that most people are just economically useless from the perspective of the system. And since the people serve the system and not the other way around, they're left in this kind of existential void where they don't really know what they're meant to do. And some of them hit on the idea of just walking away from it all. They go to these brownfield sites left behind by the near collapse of industrial civilization. They use software that they've stolen from the UN High Commission on Refugees to direct drones to catalog the wastelands and then design buildings that can be built out of what's left over from that collapse. And then using that same software, they engage in these kind of group projects that are something like making Wikipedia or GNU Linux, but instead they're building giant luxury hotels that maintain themselves and that anyone can stay in for free. And, you know, this kind of bohemia, this romantic bohemia on the outskirts of what they call the default world of predatory, highly bifurcated industrial capitalism is something that the very rich kind of enjoy for a while. It's a fun walk on the wild side right on their doorstep. But then everything changes because some of the scientists who are involved in figuring out how to help the rich live forever decide that they don't want to be complicit in that project. They don't want to turn the human race into two species, one of them infinitely prolonged and the other one mayflies disappearing in their rearview mirrors. And so they steal the secret of eternal life, the secret that they themselves have uncovered, and they take it to the walkaways. They give everyone the potential of eternal life, and that triggers all out blazing war with hellfire missiles and mercenaries and so on. And, you know, in the walkaway world, they've decided that they don't really need to use exchange to provide for everyone anymore, that in a world in which they can make virtually anything, in a world in which they can coordinate the use of virtually anything so that, you know, if you need a screwdriver, you can figure out where there's one sitting idle instead of everyone having to have their own screwdriver in a drawer. And then if you forget to put it away, someone else knows where it is and can find it as well. In that world, they switch from an exchange economy to a gift economy, one where things are freely given without the expectation of a reward. And this is a very hard thing to do. And it's a hard thing to do in our regular lives, too, in the real world, although it's something that we do a lot of. You know, if you've ever been for, say, marriage counseling, you'll be told that doing the chores with the expectation that your spouse will then do the chores, that kind of quid pro quo of that is it doesn't lead to a healthy relationship, that a healthy relationship is much more Marxist in nature, where, you know, each gives according to their ability and takes according to their needs, and each person is filled with compassion for the other and tries to assume good faith on the part of the other. You know, this is also characteristic of, say, child rearing, you know, where if you were to give your kid an invoice upon high school graduation for all the money you'd spent raising them and expect them to pay you back, or to do another version of that, which is to say, well, now that I'm old and you are young and entering the work life, you have a responsibility to pay me back with care for me and my dotage, as opposed to the idea that we love each other. And so when I was in a position to care for you, I cared for you. And now that you're in a position to care for me, you care for me. But without there having been a quid pro quo, with this having been just the natural outpouring of our love for one another, that very hard to walk, hard to define fine line between transactionalism and love is this thing that we're already working very hard at in our daily lives. And that, you know, the rise of markets as the defining organizing principle in our world has made harder for us to navigate. That, you know, back when markets were a thing that you went to for an afternoon once every 2 weeks, we had different ways of thinking about our social relationships. But now that markets are a kind of moral philosophy that determine how we relate to one another and that pick the winners and the losers, and that, you know, by de facto say that the people who markets make rich are the good people, now we're in this much more difficult and fraught position.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Cory Doctorow about his latest work of speculative fiction, Walkaway. But this post-scarcity economy, this gift economy that you talk about in the book, in your novel, Cory Doctorow, in Walkaway, is predicated on an extremely advanced technology, on, 3D printing and, an almost magical way of taking detritus and turning it into something. And, I was contrasting this technological utopia to the vision of, say, John Michael Greer or James Howard Kunstler, who predict a kind of utopia based on technological devolution, you know, back to the kind of 19th century level of technology. So does this gift economy, this doing things because of the love of doing them and the love of the people you're doing them for, depend on technological abundance, or can it still exist in a world of scarcity?
Well, you know, I'm very skeptical of the degrowth project overall, this idea that our path to happiness is to somehow convince 4 or 5 billion people to quietly die so that we can sustain ourselves in a low-tech way. You know, that what that generally gets us is destroying lots of natural habitats in the name of a kind of nonsensical commitment to things like organic farming, where we decree one kind of pesticide to not really be a pesticide. And then we grow in the least efficient way we can imagine, so that we end up devouring the habitats that are the other denizens of this planet rely on, as opposed to technologically intensive ways of living in cities where we have very efficient ways of allocating our resources. You know, I've written 3 books now about scarcity and abundance. The first one was my first novel, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. And that was really about not just about what we can make, but about what we want. And that's really what the degrowth left is concerned with. The idea that maybe we can just convince people to want less and then we'll have abundance. And it's true that abundance is very much tied up with what we want. That, you know, someone who wants 20 kids has a very different definition of abundance than someone who wants 0. In terms of the amount of resources that they'll require for their whole life. And, you know, Mary Kondo and her ilk have engaged in this project, as Corey Seacrest says, to convince us that all we really need is a single smooth river rock that reminds us of our mother. But, you know, it's been thousands of years since the founding of Buddhism, and it seems like our appetite for what we want is unlimited. Certainly when Keynes predicted in 1930 that by 2015 we'd all be working 2-hour weeks because that would be all it would take to supply everything that everyone needed, he was right about how much we could produce with a relatively small amount of labor, but dreadfully wrong about how much we would desire as our labor enabled us to make more. But there's another aspect of abundance, and that's what I conquered or addressed in my novel, Makers, Makers is really about how efficiently we can make things. And we're getting much better at making things. The things that we use today, that we make today, embody so much less energy and material and labor that it's really hard to overstate. There's a wonderful study by these Bank of Canada economists who are giant IKEA nuts. And they took this stacks of old IKEA catalogs and used them as a data set to figure out what the correlates were of pieces of furniture enduring in the IKEA catalog from year to year. And what they found is that the IKEA furniture that endures becomes lighter every year, and it has fewer countries of manufacture, and it it packs down into fewer cubic inches for shipping. In other words, through efficiency, these material objects end up embodying so much less physical material, so much less labor, and so much less energy that two Billy bookcases separated by a decade of manufacture are really two totally different objects with orders of magnitude less material and energy and labor embodied in them. And so when people say, well, how can everyone live like an American when it would take six planet Earths for us all to do so, the answer might be that we reduce the material inputs into an American's life by 5/6. And then finally, there's this last piece, the piece that I approach in Walkaway, which is how we allocate things, how things end up from one place and go from one place to another, how people source things at the moment that they need them. And again, it's something that industrial capitalism has been pretty good at in some regards, you know, the kind of just-in-time manufacturing and long supply chains that allow desire and material good to be married at the very moment that they're needed, is really a great triumph of market capitalism. But it's also produced so much waste at the margins that it begs for a kind of science fiction reconsideration of how we might cleave the social and economic context from the technological accomplishment, how we might imagine a kind of Zipcar version of fully automated luxury communism, where instead of everyone owning, you know, the 30th best lawnmower that we can imagine and leaving in their garage for 13 and a half days out of 14, that instead we lower the opportunity cost of figuring out where an amazing lawnmower is at any given second and making sure that probabilistically lawnmowers are always close by to whoever needs them. And at the very moment that you need to mow your lawn, the most incredible lawnmower you can imagine, a lawnmower that is continuously refactored based on use data, that is designed to gracefully degrade back into the material stream when its duty cycle is over, is married to your hand just as you need it. And then rather than you paying the cost of storing it and maintaining it and having to keep track of it and the kind of the opportunity cost of owning a thing that is only barely useful, instead that it just neatly disappears into the hand of the next person who might want it, that this is better than a system of kind of 11th best compromised private property. It's a system of public goods that are smart enough to figure out where people need them so that you never have the anxiety of trying to figure out where that drill is at the two times a year that you need to make a hole in the wall. Instead, all of those material things and you are engaged in a kind of endless orbital dance where your orbits intersect at these opportune moments and then part ways gracefully when your need for liaison is passed. And that's what Walkaway tries to address. And between them, these three things, engineering what we want, engineering how we make it, and engineering where it is at the moment that we need it, that is an answer to scarcity and abundance that only requires that we rethink our relationships to one another and doesn't require that billions of people die. And I think in that regard, this Promethean version of the left is so much superior to the degrowth kind of green left bourgeois shireism where we all wear leather aprons and retreat to a kind of agrarian existence of, you know, working our looms.
Oh, yeah. Well, that is a fascinating vision. We actually just touched the surface. I would have loved to have had the time to talk with you about the whole idea of immortality, but we'll have to leave that to our readers. I know you have to go, Cory Doctorow, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us here. This really is a terrific and extremely thought-provoking book, Walkaway, a novel.
Thank you. Can I say one final word about the book before I go?
Oh, please do.
I just want to say that although there's all these very abstract ways of thinking and talking about the book, that fundamentally, I'm a pulp fiction writer. I write adventure stories. And Walk Away, at its core, isn't just a kind of thought-provoking book with ideas about the 21st century and whatnot. It's an adventure yarn full of, you know, people and zeppelins shooting at people in giant mecha suits with railguns. And that it's not a boring and abstract read. It's a very novelistic kind of novel. It's a novel full of stuff happening where the plot is at the center and the ideas are in service to the plot and not the other way around.
Well, I hope I didn't imply that. I'm as excited by the thought-provoking aspect of it as by the Pulp Fiction aspect of it. And thanks so much.
All right.
Cory Doctorow. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Walk Away and to hear our previous interview with him about his novel Makers. Next up, we talk with a photojournalist who witnessed the beating of DeAndre Harris by white nationalist thugs on August 12th in Charlottesville. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. On Saturday, August 12th, special education teacher DeAndre Harris was viciously assaulted by a group of white nationalist thugs in a parking garage just adjacent to a police station. The police were not there, but my next guest was. Zach Roberts is a photojournalist and videographer whose image of the beating going on in front of his eyes went viral. He also got a shot of one of the thugs aiming a gun at Harris and his friends as they were making their escape from the garage. We called Roberts up to find out what he saw and what happened next. So, Zach Roberts, now you are a photojournalist, you're associate producer and videographer for Greg Palast. We've talked to him about his film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. And now you were down on Saturday, August 12th in Charlottesville, and you actually witnessed the attack on special education teacher DeAndre Harris when he was set upon by a group of white supremacist thugs and beaten. Tell us what happened and what you saw.
So I was marching along in a relatively, as much as you can have a relatively, you know, peaceful protest with white supremacists, marching along, and there's some yelling back and forth, and then suddenly DeAndre Harris starts running and is being chased by about a dozen white supremacists, and he's chased into a garage. He's knocked down to the ground with one of the white supremacists' shield. He falls into the parking arm. And this is when he tells me he fell unconscious very briefly, and then that's when the beating really commences. It was just a brief moment, but they got in dozens of punches with pikes, with wooden poles. They picked up the parking arm and started hitting him with that. Basically, feet, fists, and anything they could possibly use to hit him while they had a chance to hit a young black kid on the ground. Thankfully, he was able to get away with the help of his friends who ran in to make the white supremacists scatter a little bit. At that moment, I turn around to follow DeAndre to make sure he's okay and hopefully get some photos of him as well. And that's when I'm confronted with a man with a handgun, 9mm Glock, as far as I can tell, who is pointing it at DeAndre and his friends and in the general area, the counter-protesters standing there in the parking garage. Thankfully, the moment that he saw me is when he put away his gun, because like most fascists, when they're confronted, they back down, which is something that I've been telling everybody that, you know, we need to do is start confronting these people more and more. So that's the very quick and brief version of events that I witnessed.
Well, that is such a shocking thing to have witnessed. When you talk about confronting them, what do you mean?
All that I mean when I say confront them is that you show up and tell them, especially as white people. I'm a white guy. I got blonde hair, blue eyes. I want people in the media and everywhere to confront them and at least show up, take their photo. And they're supposedly proud of who they are, what their skin color is, and then expose them. They're your neighbor. They're your mailman. They're your milkman, if those still exist. And put a name to that face if these people are going to do it, and they will back down. because these guys are not, thankfully, not the fascists of old, but they're these new white supremacists. A lot of them are young, and they need to be confronted, not by violence, but just literally by showing up and telling people that they're not welcome there, that most of the residents that I met of Charlottesville were on the streets yelling at them, "You're not welcome here. Go home." Because, I mean, Charlottesville is seemingly a very progressive town, I've been told. It looked like a very, you know, hip, kind of, you know, cool town, a lot of hipster vibe going on with new coffee shops and stuff like that that were all closed, unfortunately. But that these people were not welcome here. So when they show up here to your town, there's supposed to be a big rally on in Boston. I would really like to see, this is kind of my little activist side, not my journalist hat, I would like to see people show up in mass numbers. I want to see the Women's March happen every single time that these fascists show up in your hometown. I want to see 100,000 people confront the 500 white supremacists in standing and trying to defend a Confederate statue, trying to celebrate slavery and the oppression of hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions. So that's what I mean. I don't expect or want everyone to show up with clubs or body armor. That's only going to end poorly. But these guys will back down if, say, you know, if 10,000 middle-class white women show up in pink pussy hats and tell them to go home, they will back down.
That sounds like a wonderful idea. You know, I wanted to also ask you, you interviewed DeAndre Harris a day later. Tell us a little bit about that interview, what he said.
Well, I showed DeAndre the full set of photos because obviously I took a bunch of photos around the one photo that you see that's viral that shows DeAndre Harris kind of in a prone position trying to protect himself under the body, just like holding his arms against his, you know, kidneys and soft areas. And these guys are beating him with clubs. He doesn't remember any of this happening because obviously he was unconscious, he was injured. And when I showed him the photos, one of the first things he said was, "My God, this really reminds me of the black and white photos of the civil rights era," which, you know, is an honor. Civil rights era photography is the reason I went into photojournalism to begin with. As a kid, looking at all those books and seeing that's something that I could do, something to expose the terribleness, the edges of our society. That's why I went into photojournalism. So he said that this reminds me of that, and he can't believe that this is happening again in 2017. Mind you, I don't know how the guy is standing right now. He stood up and he did a dozen or so interviews while I was hanging out around him. Unlike a lot of people who understandably kind of like go, I'd rather not have my face on camera, he's showing up and telling people that if they show up again, they're not welcome here, that the white supremacists need to go home, they need to rethink their lives. And this, mind you, while he has a broken wrist, he has several stitches right above his eye on his eyebrow. He has eight metal staples in his head. And just is bruised and bloody all across his body. I don't know how he doesn't have broken ribs, but thankfully he doesn't. So he is out there and he's ready for, you know, the long, you know, say fight. not in a violent way, but just the long struggle. Thankfully, and thankfully people are, you know, supporting him through his GoFundMe page. He's, you know, very thankful for that. And, you know, he'll be able to pay his very extensive medical bills that he had because he wasn't even able to be treated at an ER. They sent him to a proper hospital to be treated. So he had to move several times from different care. Long after, mind you, the police have done absolutely nothing and never contacted him to take a statement or anything. They haven't contacted me. They haven't contacted the videographer that was there on the scene. So I'm not quite sure what's going on that end, at least.
And you point out that this attack took place right next to a police station, and yet the police were nowhere in evidence either there or even in many of the other venues of the march, you know, the actions.
Yeah, yeah. No, there was a seemingly some level of what we call a stand-down order. It's not an official term. But basically, when you see things like the Black Lives Matter march go up on freeways and things like that, that's kind of a stand-down order. They allowed the protest to happen. But the difference is with Black Lives Matter, almost none of these things happen without at least a dozen arrests. You know, a couple hundred people show up and a dozen of them get arrested because, you know, they did something that the police see as particularly illegal or dangerous or something like that. Or just in general, usually it's just they didn't like, you know, what they were yelling at the cops. But there were, as far as I never witnessed an arrest the entire weekend, which was just mind-blowing. I just realized that this morning that I don't have a photograph of anyone being arrested. They had all these plastic cuffs, you know, the little handcuffs that are like zip ties, and I never saw somebody use them. And in the same way, the police were always just never to be found when bad things happen. And when they did finally show up, all they did was lock down the scene so that members of the media couldn't photograph and get to it. I was there just after Heather was killed, or she was still alive at the time, but right after the terrorist attack. And all that they did was they locked down the scene. They showed up with one of the APC Bearcats, popped up the top with a police officer in full body armor at the top who had a smoke, you know, one of those, it's like a grenade launcher that shoots smoke canisters or tear gas, and that's all they did. They didn't provide any medical attention. It was all on these supposedly terrible, you know, counter-protesters, these violent Antifa. The Antifa medics were basically the heroes of the weekend. They're the only they're the only people who showed up to help DeAndre after he was bleeding excessively from his face. The hospital told him that he was very near, you know, the impassable level of blood loss. He was very lucky that they got in finally when they did. And it took 15 minutes, or it took 25 minutes for anyone to even, the police to even show up to protect DeAndre from, like, possible further attack. And then at the car scene, they weren't doing anything other than just standing by in their body armor. I mean, these guys are trained, supposedly at least usually, in medical care, in first aid, and they were doing nothing as people were laying bleeding and broken bones on the ground. It was mind-blowing to see the lack of care, just human ability from the police in Charlottesville. When Antifa, these supposed, you know, people who are equally bad as white fascists, were giving the only aid and medical care to the people that were injured in this terrorist attack. It was just, it's mind-blowing to watch the president talk about these people this way and equate the violence as anywhere near equal, or these people as anywhere near equal. It's unconscionable.
We're talking with photojournalist Zach Roberts about his witnessing of the beating of DeAndre Harris by white supremacists on August 12th in Charlottesville, Virginia. His photo of the attack went viral. Roberts has written an account of that assault. You also confronted a guy who actually had a gun in the parking garage where DeAndre Harris was assaulted.
Yes.
And the police did not respond to that in any way?
No, so right after DeAndre Harris finally was able to get up and at least make a short run, as he kept falling down because he was so brutally injured, but he was able to get away, I turned around to follow and was immediately confronted with a man that was in, you know, looked like military issue T-shirt and kind of pants, and wearing a little camouflage hat. And he had pointed out what I believe is a 9mm Glock, pointed in the direction of DeAndre and DeAndre's friends. And he had very excellent trigger discipline, which makes me assume that he has some level of training and he wasn't just some, you know, yokel with a gun, you know, sort of thing, some guy responding. Like, he knew what he was doing. He specifically had an idea of what he was doing by pulling out his handgun. And the moment that I took his photos and he could hear the shutter, you know, in the parking garage, which echoed loudly, he put his gun away. So, like, that's what I say, you know, that's why I emphasize when people are confronted, when these fascists are confronted, you know, even simply with a, you know, a Nikon D600, they'll back down. And thankfully, he put his gun away and moved on. But yeah, it was by far one of the more jarring things that I've had. Dozens and dozens of police guns pointed in my direction, and covered the NRA convention, covered these things. I'm very comfortable, relatively comfortable around handguns, but this was, it still shakes me that this could have been a much, much worse situation if, you know, that guy had decided that he felt threatened in the moment and started shooting.
And would that have been legal in the state of Virginia?
That's a very good question. I mean, him having the handgun and open carrying, was legal. I'm still trying to find out whether it was legal or not for him to pull a handgun on unarmed people. But if this is Florida, it's 100% legal. He's standing his ground. He feels threatened. He's a very emotional white man who feels threatened by young black men. So clearly, you know, he needs to stand his ground in this moment, in the middle of a parking garage that he has many different escapes, you know, able to leave if he wants to. It's not his own property, but he could have left. He could have not been there. He could have done whatever he wants, but he decided to, quote unquote, stand his ground. I'm not 100% sure. You're right. I need to check that if Virginia is a stand your ground state. But I have very little doubt if he shot a couple people that he would end up at the end of the day being prosecuted. Just with this police department and their lack of interest in prosecuting the brutal, well-documented, brutal beating of a young black kid who's from Charlottesville and is a special ed teacher. He's not some gangbanger. He's not any of the stereotypes that they want to throw on him, even though the media keeps... He's also an aspiring hip-hop artist, and for some reason, the LA Times and a couple other places, that's what they lead with. Personally, I led with the fact that he's a special ed teacher. He's the kind of guy that I really, really want in my society. I really want more DeAndre Harris's around. But, you know, this guy with the handgun, he felt supposedly endangered enough to be able to pull it on a couple black kids, you know, but not until... He was actually going to be photographed doing it. So, you know, that's the really important part of it, that, you know, when confronted, these fascists back down.
Just one last point. There is an update to the movie that you co-produced with Greg Pallas, that is The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, a post-election update?
Yeah, we are. I mean, if you noticed, a while back when it was in the media, Chris Kobach, our guy that we've been following it's been a decade now that we've been tracking this guy, this big voter suppressor from Kansas. He is now, as I hope you all your listeners know, he is now the vice chair of the voter integrity, whatever they want to call it. I call it the voter suppression panel, along with Mike Pence. So now, and he's also one of the three top names listed for the head of Department of Homeland Security. This is the guy who was already kicked out of Homeland Security when he was working for the Bush administration. So you know how bad this guy has got to be. The Bush administration pushed him out for being potentially too racist. And if, you know, anybody who was around during that time and conscious of politics, you know how extreme that must be. So, yeah, that we're updating constantly. There's all new info. I'm sure that we'll be now updating it again with, Charlottesville, because all of this ties in. All of this is tied in together to keep certain groups of people in this country down. And they do that by showing up in their polo shirts and comfortable shoes, yelling Nazi slogans. They do that by stopping African Americans from voting. They do that by redistricting. This is a top-to-bottom disenfranchisement battle that has been being waged for decades. Ever since the Civil Rights Act, basically, it's been step after step, the Republican Party and, you know, these far-right groups have been step-by-step trying to make sure that certain groups of people in this country, I'm sure you can guess who they are, that they don't get their rightful place and their rightful ability to even pull themselves up by their bootstraps, as, the Republican Party loves that phrase so much. And so This is all part of it. And so, yeah, we're updating it. So, you know, please go to gregpalace.com and you can check for continued updates. You can check out my photos. Greg wrote a very nice piece about me. And please check that out and go and subscribe. I'm also over at nationofchange.org, where I write pretty much exclusively for, and you'll be able to find updates on my work and also Greg's work. Obviously, they're so intricately tied in together. So yeah, please keep up with everything.
We will post all those links, and I just want to emphasize that last so important point you made, that this is called the so-called alt-right. I don't think it's so alternate. There is a continuum between the right wing, the Republican Party, the conservative movement in the United States that's been going on for a long time to disenfranchise people of color, and these white supremacists.
There is no line. There is no line between the modern Republican Party and the alt-right. And there's a very, very fine line between the modern Republican Party and the guys that showed up in I was going to call it Confederate Square. I'm sorry, it's now Emancipation Park, formerly Lee Park, Robert E. Lee Park. They renamed it just, back in June. There's a very, very fine line, if not any line at all, between these groups of people and the current incarnation of the Republican Party, and especially the President of the United States. Everybody who says that, you know, they're kind of shocked by the level of defense of Donald Trump's racism and Donald Trump's defending the alt-right and the Nazis and the and everything and equating these people. You know, everyone has to remember that. If you were a New Yorker, if you were conscious, or you read the Village Voice, you know, throughout the 80s, this is the guy that took out a full page ad in the Times, or I think it was the New York Times, calling on the Central Park Five, who were wrongfully convicted and spent years in jail, partially thanks to the scaremongering that Donald Trump pushed. He bought a full page ad calling for these people to. I believe it was for the death penalty for these guys.
It was.
And so, like, let's not believe that this is some new thing, or that Donald Trump is hearing discussions about them on CNN. You know, oh well, maybe they need to get rid of Bannon, you know, and get rid of Stephen Miller. No, this is Donald Trump. This is the people that the Republican Party, en masse, voted for and consciously knew. I mean, Donald Trump's an open racist and an open bigot. He doesn't hide this stuff. It's not coded language. He's not doing dog whistle. He directly calls Mexicans rapists en masse. Oh, I'm sorry, and I'm sure there's a few good people. this is not any hiding. And I think, again, we need to confront every day, through whether it be through the language of the media, through the language of your friends and relatives, and confront the fact that this is not a person that is now in the White House who has a cabinet filled with white supremacists and racists. And we need to start, you know, labeling these people what they are. Not, you know, they're not the alt-right. They're white supremacists. They're white. They're at best a term that Chris Kobach is continually called is a nativist. People who they're not racist. They don't hate brown people or black people. They just want their country to be like it was, you know, back in the 50s, and they just want it to be a white country like it's supposed to be. You know, never mind all those pesky Native Americans still running around.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, this was just terrific to talk with you. I want to thank you so much.
Thank you.
Zach Roberts, your work is so important, and we will link to the video as well as the piece that you wrote and Greg Palace's piece. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. You know, I have to care that careful thing of, because I don't want to be labeled, I don't want to be labeled as an activist. I don't want to be labeled as that, because then it takes away, then the photograph was taken by an activist, and it immediately withdraws a lot of the importance of the image and the photos that I take and the journalism work that I do, because it's, you know, through this guise of an activist. I'm like, no, when I'm a photojournalist, I don't care. I have photos and I publish photos of Antifa and African Americans that were there, the counter protesters hitting people. I've published those photos. They haven't gone viral. They haven't, you know, whatever. I wouldn't want them to, because it doesn't really tell that full story of the day. It's just an instant which usually they were responding to violence or something. But yeah, so.
Yeah, and let's not forget that during World War II, it was journalists like, oh God, now what was his name? The famous guy who went up against Joe McCarthy. But during World War II, he was stationed in London. I don't know, you know, it's kind of a moment. But
Edward R. Murrow, right? Yeah.
Exactly. Well, he was fearless in condemning the Nazis.
Yeah, no, we forget that very quickly, that a lot of our you know, straight-laced journalistic heroes were quite loud about condemning these people. But again, you know, I hate the term mainstream media because I know a lot of the mainstream media, and they're fantastic, hardworking people. But, you know, the language at which is used, the NPR kind of, well, we can't equate the two sides, or we can't equate Steve Bannon. He's not a racist because I don't know what's in his head. And I'm like, well, you have to listen to his words. That's how you know if somebody's a racist or not. Do they say racist things? Yes, then they're a racist. It's easy to figure out. Donald Trump, Steve Bannon, most of his cabinet are racist. And they own it. And, you know, if the media didn't push against it, and a lot of their fund, the Koch brothers or whatever who fund these guys didn't back away from the term racist, they'd just be fine with being called a racist because it's a proud thing. I mean, basically Donald Trump just stood up and said, I'm proud to be these guys. You know, I mean, so I think the conversation should be over about, you know, trying to be what would be called even-handed.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. Okay, well, thanks again, and this was terrific.
Thanks so much.
Zach Roberts is a photojournalist and associate producer and videographer for Greg Palast's film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. He also writes for Nation of Change. Roberts has written an account of the assault on DeAndre Harris. Find a link at writersvoice.net.